Hello, I'm Barry Daniel, and this is the podcast of the Middle Way Society. Our aim is to encourage a universal approach to living a more integrated, ethical life, avoiding dogma or any appeal to authority. My guest today is the writer and broadcaster Vishvapani Blomfeld, who's going to talk to us about mindfulness and the Middle Way, both from a more secular and a more traditional Buddhist perspective. Hello, Vishvapani. Welcome to the MWS podcast.
Hello, Barry. Hi.
Okay, could you begin by telling us about something of your life and background?
Okay. So I was born in South London, Croydon. I had a Reformed Jewish upbringing. Uh-huh. But both of my parents were psychotherapists, or are psychotherapists. And there was some kind of tension between that. And in any case, I had a bar mitzvah, and then I quite quickly stopped considering myself as Jewish in any religious way, although I do in a more cultural way.
Yeah.
And subsequently, quite soon after, in fact, encountered Buddhism in the form of meditation classes in my particular London suburb, and really enthusiastic, became a Buddhist, and this was the Tri Ratna Buddhist order, Buddhist community under its previous name, Friends of the Western Buddhist Order.
Yeah.
And that's actually been my Buddhist stroke religious affiliation ever since. So en route since then, and that was age 14, 15. Then I was involved with that particular Buddhist community. I went to university. I was in an English group of 10 of us, 12 of us, with none other than Robert Ellis, the founder of the Middle Way Society. And after that, for many years, I worked for the Tri Ratna Buddhist community.
Yeah.
I edited a magazine called Dharma Life, became very fascinated by all of the things that were happening then and continue to happen as Buddhism in particular has come into Western culture, how that relationship has evolved and what it really means. I was ordained into the Tri Ratna Buddhist community. I got the name Vishvapani.
What does that mean to be ordained?
It means, it's a very modest name that means something like holder of the universe. So that's a lot to live up to. Anyway, that was when I was 27.
Yeah.
So that's 22 years ago. I worked for in the community. I edited Dharma Life magazine and did all sorts of other things. Some years ago, I stopped working for the community in a formal way. I started working as more as a freelance writer and editor. So I've written Substantial Life of the Buddha. I broadcast on Thought for the Day. I now live in Cardiff, mm-hmm, with my wife and 4-year-old son. And what else? I teach mindfulness. So as this secular mindfulness movement has developed, I've embraced that really, and I'm a very committed, very engaged teacher of mindfulness courses, mainly for the general public, but in other ways as well.
Okay, and that presumably by that you mean mindfulness-based stress reduction?
Yes, there are actually various forms of this thing. So mindfulness-based cognitive therapy is strictly speaking what most people teaching mindfulness in the UK teach. That's what I teach.
Yeah. So what do you see as the strengths and limitations of this more secular interpretation of mindfulness?
Well, for someone like me, who's been practicing mindfulness for many, many years and teaching meditation for many years as well, what's happened, particularly over the last decade, with the adoption of secular mindfulness in a wider society is really quite amazing. Mm. It's just astonishing to me. I mean, I looked at the Amazon bestseller list yesterday, and there are two books on mindfulness in the top 20.
Wow. Which ones are they?
Mark Williams' book, Finding Peace in a Frantic World, and a book by Ruby Wax called Sane New World.
Wow.
So there are, and that's just one outward sign of what's happening. And media's full of mindfulness. There's a rather attractive blonde woman on the cover of Time magazine, and the title, The Mindful Revolution, or The Mindfulness Revolution. So something's happened, and I'm very, very happy about that, because I think the courses are making meditation accessible on a much wider scale, much wider than we ever imagined would be possible. And they're also bringing with them one or two of the most fundamental teachings and lessons of the mind in a way that is quite brilliantly constructed. That's why these courses have been so successful. It's quite a brilliant packaging exercise by Jon Kabat-Zinn. The fundamental lessons, and this is what I see people encountering, are firstly that you've got a mind, which is so fundamental to our lives. But, you know, when our minds are working fine and we're quite happy, we don't think about them. We think, I'm just me.
Yeah.
With my experience. But when our minds don't work, they don't do what we want them to do. And that's what happens when people get stressed, or they get anxious, or they can't get to sleep at night, or any of those things. They get depressed and they're in hell for 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
Then what that confronts you with is you've got a mind. And the second part of that is that the mind is conditioned. That the states of mind we experience arise from certain causes and conditions. And we don't really, in the first instance, know what those are. And then mindfulness techniques give people ways of working with their minds.
Yeah.
So that is really, leaving aside the content of mindfulness techniques and even the style of them, that is such a fundamentally radical teaching to offer people. And it turns out that many of the messages that our society give us about how our minds work and what we think will make us happy are wrong. Hence we have an epidemic, really, of stress, anxiety, depression, which seems, from what we can tell, to be getting worse and worse, and the younger, especially among younger people. So there's a tremendous need for this, and that's really why mindfulness has hit a nerve recently. And those lessons, if you're familiar with the Dhammapada, one of the key collections of Buddhist sayings and teachings, it starts with those lessons. So Buddhism really starts with the lesson, all things are proceed from the mind, developed by mind, led by the mind. So the fact that we have a mind, it's the fundamental reality of our lives, and that they're conditioned, and that we can influence those conditions in various ways. For me, that is the fundamental teaching of Buddhism.
Okay.
And that lesson is conveyed by the secular mindfulness movement. However, and although I'm very committed to that movement, it does have certain limitations. The main one that's kind of built into it, that's intrinsic, is it's based around 8-week mindfulness courses. You can't master anything in 8 weeks. I mean, if you had an 8-week piano playing course that offered to make you a wonderful pianist, we would laugh at that. So that, I think, is purely contingent. It's purely because of economics, actually, that an 8-week course is a convenient kind of time period. And the other problem that follows from that, or some of the attitudes around that, is that it's so tempting for people to think that they can start teaching this stuff really easily and really quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And that misunderstands the nature of mindfulness teaching. And actually, the people who are in most influential positions, like Jon Kabat-Zinn in the States and Mark Williams in this country, are quite clear themselves that mindfulness is something you have to embody. And it's caught as much as it's taught. It's something that you, it's not a technique in itself. It's more an attitude and a way of, a turn of mind, a way of living. So you can't teach mindfulness any more than you can teach people to write poetry. Yes, you can give them techniques, but that doesn't make them a great poet. So although that isn't inherent in the mindfulness movement, it's very tempting to think of it as a technique. And that is the way that corporations and government are tending to look at mindfulness. So that is a big problem that we have to try and address or try and offset, I think.
Remember something that Stephen Batchelor said?
Yeah.
He says he sort of sees it as a bit like a Trojan horse for a lot of the more spiritual, ethical or Buddhist grounding of mindfulness. People come to this first maybe just because they want to, as you say, be more relaxed or less stressed. But if one does embrace it as a way of being, then these things will inevitably, are likely to follow. What do you think about that?
Well, I don't know about inevitably. I don't even know about likely. And I also don't know about Trojan horses. Jon Kabat-Zinn's phrase that got him into a lot of trouble, actually, was stealth Buddhism. A stealth fighter comes in under the radar, doesn't it? And it evades all detection. Then next thing you know, you've been bombed. And the Trojan horse fooled the Trojans, and that was their way into Troy.
Yeah.
So I think we've got to be careful about any of those ideas about tricking people into adopting Buddhism. We've got to be very clear that we're offering them something that people can take on any level, and they can explore or they cannot explore as they want. So that's really about the motives that one brings to teaching mindfulness.
Okay.
And at the same time, I think I would rather think of a slightly more benign metaphor, like a seed. You sow a seed and it might flourish, it might flower, it might not. Even that metaphor is not quite right, because people can make of mindfulness what they want.
Yeah.
But I do think, and I actually want to write a book about this, I do think that the following that seed metaphor, I do think that the seed that you sow with mindfulness has a certain integrity. And if it's offered in the right spirit, then I think other things will follow on from it.
Okay.
I mean, I don't think everything necessarily follows on from it. And this actually might tie in with some of the philosophical emphases that I really appreciate in Robert Ellis's work. Because I think what we believe is very important when it comes to ethics. And I don't think mindfulness goes anywhere near that. I mean, for example, if you believe that the ends justify the means and the desirable end is equality of all and brotherhood of all mankind, and that the communist revolution is the way to achieve that,
Then
your very good intentions will lead you to all the things that history shows us it can produce. And you will consider yourself a highly ethical person. Even however mindful you are, you may have misgivings and qualms, but your beliefs will be telling you that your actions are justified. So that's why I don't think any approach to developing the mind is sufficient in itself unless it addresses underlying fundamental core beliefs.
Yeah. Okay. Well, on that point, do you think this is where potentially the middle way comes in as a principle of interpretation? So, for example, you know, you hear now that in the American army, soldiers are being taught to kill mindfully. So mindfulness is being seen as an end in itself. So anything can become extreme if you're not careful. And maybe that's why we need a way of interpreting things so we can look at them in a more proportionate provisional way?
Well, we certainly need the middle way, and we certainly need proportionate ways of looking at things. I don't actually think the US Marines are being trained to kill mindfully. If you've got a stress reduction or techniques, or ways of managing your stress, you can't imagine a more stressful situation than being in Afghanistan with people firing rockets and setting off IEDs and so on. So it's more about how you manage your state of mind under stress. It so happens that this particular state of mind, is the particular lifestyle these people have, is one that causes other people many qualms.
Yeah. Okay. There seems to be an ever increasing body of evidence to suggest that mindfulness does what it says on the tin. Couldn't that in some way be counterproductive? Either practitioners become very goal oriented.
Well, I think a lot of the criticisms of mindfulness, we have to take on what mindfulness courses actually involve.
Yeah.
At least when they're taught well, and they actually involve looking at one's tendency to be goal oriented, and the cost of that.
Yeah.
So. That's why this is so interesting, because it has certain things built into it that resist the temptation to turn it into a technique.
Yeah.
And it becomes bad mindfulness at that point.
Yeah. Okay. One perception of mindfulness, or in more general terms, meditation, is that it can be seen as narcissistic or navel gazing is often the term used. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I go back to what I said initially, that the mind, for me, is a fundamental reality of our lives.
Yeah.
And unless we're addressing our states of mind, we're not really addressing who we are as human beings. And that seems to me so fundamental that it's really missing a very important point, if we call that navel gazing. Everything comes out of our being in a good state of mind, including our capacity to be compassionate, to be loving, to be present with other people, to be fully aware of the society around us and its needs, and to be active in addressing those things. So many of the problems that activists and social workers and so on experience, I know many people like that, are because they have difficulties with their states of mind.
Yeah.
And often in political areas, particularly, people act quite unconsciously in ways that end up being very unhelpful, driven by anger, rage, and things that are quite unexamined.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if mindfulness is about the examined life, yes, then I think that's really important. But navel gazing, that's just rhetoric.
Yeah. Right, in your recent Thought for the Day slot on Radio 4, you said the mindfulness movement may seem a surprising marriage of the secular and the religious. Isn't there a possible middle way here, though, between secularity and religiosity?
Yes, well, I'm saying it may seem that,
yeah,
to people, and I think it genuinely does seem that. I mean, what other technique or resource is there that's come out of something that, you know, has been a religious tradition and has proved so profoundly useful and relevant to modern life? I mean, there are things like hatha yoga and tai chi and so on, but mindfulness is along with those and maybe the most prominent. So it's the surprise, I think, is that things that are embedded in the what's seemingly a religious context turn out to be so relevant, regardless of faith and creed and history as well.
Okay. What are your understanding of those terms, secular and religious?
Well, I don't consider myself a dictionary, so I want to subscribe to a particular definition. But when I think of secularity, I think of firstly something that rejects a framework, a metaphysical framework that we're familiar with in the major world religions, with Buddhism being a query in that.
Okay.
That emphasizes this world and the experience that we have in this life rather than future lives or past lives. And often is connected with a materialist outlook in terms of what the mind being essentially a function of the body and so on. It would be those sorts of things that I would.
And religious? Do you associate religious principally with belief?
No, I take religious to be a more of a kind of anthropological term.
Okay.
So if it looks religious and it has certain characteristics, then you can call it religious. But there are so many differences between religion. I mean, if you go to a Buddhist country and you see people engaging in worship and devotion and ritual, then I'm happy to call that religious.
Yep.
Though not in a definitive way, not to say that that's the same as the ritual and devotion that's conducted in a Christian context, for example. But there is clearly some kind of family resemblance between them.
Yeah. So by saying that you're not religious, is it a bit like saying you're not historical or you're not geographical in the sense that it's part of our evolutionary makeup?
Yeah, I mean, one way I do think about this, and I'm not sure how much this illuminates Buddhism, is in terms of Jewishness, I'm very clear, I don't subscribe to the Jewish religion. I wouldn't find much value in attending a synagogue or anything like that. But then there's, but Judaism, Jewishness rather, has a number of dimensions. And there's a world of secular Jews who don't follow the religious tenets of the religious faith. So it has a content that isn't so identifiable with the specifically religious content.
Okay, yeah. Right, so, well, from the middleway society perspective, we both avoid secular positions, i.e. ones that deny the existence of metaphysical claims, but also the positive ones as well. You've known Robert Ellis for a long time. How familiar are you with this interpretation of the middle way put forward by the middle way society?
Yeah, I'm broadly familiar with it, but don't test me on it.
Right. Okay. Well, let's move on to this subject in a bit more detail then, because I think it's an area of interest for you, that the relationship between secular applications or non-religious in the belief sense of the middle way and the more religious ones found in Buddhism. Could you tell us your thoughts on that?
Okay, so when I look at Buddhist teachings, what I find is two emphases which operate in tandem and sometimes in tension. And one of those emphases is what I see being picked up by secular Buddhists and people like that. And I actually would rather avoid characterizing the middle way society position. I let its own members do that.
Yeah.
So this one position is one that says we need to work out for ourselves, drawing on our own experience, what is helpful.
Yeah.
What's skillful, what's unskillful. And we can test this empirically. The Buddha, for example, and no doubt others, offer ways to develop the mind, to develop spiritually. We try them out. They might work. They might not work. We make our own sense of them. And that would be an empirical and empirical approach that's broadly rationalizable. It's not exclusively rational by any means, but you can put that in quite rational terms.
Yeah.
Now, that there's something else in the Buddhist tradition, and this is the bit that gets called religious. When you see in the Buddhist texts accounts of why people become followers of the Buddha, the account starts with a Buddha arises in the world.
Okay.
So someone wakes up from this dream of existence. They see the truth of things. The point is that there's a side of Buddhism that starts with the Buddha, that starts with someone gaining enlightenment and seeing something that other people can't see for themselves. They see the things that you can't work out for yourself empirically. How can I understand who I really am when I'm doing it from inside my own mind and my own conditioning, my own narrow perspective? So then there's the aspect of opening oneself up to the truth of, to what, you know, purports at least to be the truth of the teachings that are offered with authority and which you can't verify. So even if you're testing them out empirically, there's still an act of faith. And this, to be truly effective, has to be a heartfelt act of faith, not just a willingness to suspend disbelief. So within the Buddhist perspective, there's a sense of the wise, of people like the Buddha, and maybe even of reality being something that is beyond our narrowly but is not conceptualizable. And so the act of following the Buddha's teachings, or as I would say, as a Buddhist, practicing the Dharma, acting in accordance with the Dharma, which means really the truth of things.
Yeah.
That is a constant opening up of myself to something that is beyond what I can already know.
Okay.
So that is where faith comes in. And because it's not a rational process, that's where ritual comes in. That's where all these supernatural figures like Buddhas and Bodhisattvas come in, because they represent that dimension which is beyond one's own experience, is of another nature to one's own experience.
Okay. But you see the idea of an enlightened being like the Buddha, for example, as a real possibility, like of someone having existed like that? Or do you see it more in an archetypal sense, that it's a goal, a useful metaphor that we can use to guide us towards a greater degree of integration?
Well, I'm sure it is a useful metaphor that we can use to guide us towards a greater degree of information. Although I point out that the metaphor can't really work if we only regard it as a metaphor. That would be a matter of kind of tricking the mind into thinking that there was something greater than itself for the sake of the mind's own benefit. You might believe that for a short period of time, but it wouldn't carry a great deal of conviction. So I believe, hallelujah, brother, I believe that, that there are people who have gained some kind of perspective that is of a different nature, a different order from my own. And I say this as someone who fairly recently spent 3 years writing a biography of the Buddha. So a biography suggests facts and history and so on. And what we have is ancient texts, which are of sometimes questionable provenance. But nonetheless, through steeping myself in those texts, which aren't completely mythologized by any means, I came to feel I really had a feeling for the Buddha as a kind of intimate, in the way that people describe when they write biographies of literary figures and so on. And a way of thinking, a way of seeing the world, a way of responding to problems that has a kind of genius in it that I find deeply moving and deeply convincing.
We touched briefly there on integration, and it's my understanding in the Tree Ratna order that is something that is talked about quite a lot. Can you see some correlation between the middle way and Jung's notion of individuation, or what we view in the society as integration?
Right. So integration in Tree Ratna, integration in society, and Jung's idea of individuation.
In the middle way society rather than society as a whole.
But... Oh, I see. Okay. Got you. Well, again, I don't want to speak to how the middle way society understands those terms, but it seems to me that the common point is the mind. You know, what are our minds? And the fact, we start from the fact that we both can acknowledge we don't fully understand all the forces that are driving us. They aren't there available to our conscious awareness, and they're certainly not within our conscious control. If you start with that, and then the intimations that we have of all sorts of things going on in our minds, what do we fundamentally want to achieve with our lives? What really makes us happy? What are the different levels of happiness and that we might possibly experience? So if we open ourselves up to that, then we do need to start to have some kind of language about how we open up to those different levels and, you know, of individuation. With Jung's language, what I take from his language is a rather poetic way of envisaging these different elements of our consciousness, our psyche.
Okay. As well as meditation or mindfulness, do you think the arts and critical thinking are important for the middle way?
Well, the arts and critical thinking are very important for anyone who wants to develop their capacity to live more fully and to think more clearly, I think. You know, the arts, art is, first of all, I suppose art grows from the human capacity, the human desire that we always seem to have had since we were cavemen, to tell stories and create images.
Yeah.
As in cultural history, as we've become more self-aware, we want to do those things and even make sounds in ways that help us to make sense of our experience more fully. We create these images outside ourselves that are showing us more fully, more deeply, more clearly what our inner worlds are like, what other people are like, why people operate, how we come together as societies.
Yep.
And those images, and we are incredibly fortunate, are we not, that we have thousands of years, or hundreds of years anyway, of an incredibly rich literature and literary and visual arts tradition. So, yeah, that's all very, very important for me.
Now, I know that you as a Buddhist see uncertainty and the embrace of uncertainty as a very much part of your practice. Do you see the arts as a way of tolerating ambiguity?
I think ambiguity is a very important part of the arts, and partly the role of metaphor in the arts. I suppose all of the arts create images that stand for something else, so that they're all metaphors. And when we think in concepts, we're constrained by the nature of concepts. When we think when we use metaphors, we have the capacity to think in images, to think in stories. And those stories can allow, they offer access to much more complex, much subtler ways of understanding the world.
One way of interpreting the middle way is that it joins psychology with philosophy, i.e. that there are certain types of views that can only be held in a state that involves psychological rigidity, and thus are not well justified in a wider philosophical perspective. Do you think that ties in with your view of the middle way?
Yeah, so you're touching on the relationship between views and emotions, really. And I think that is such a fundamental question. I think that's one of the Buddha's great insights. For me, that insight does go back to the Buddha. He looked around at the views of people, of his contemporaries, and he analyzed them not so much in terms of their conceptual content, but in terms of their emotional content, the attitudes that, that framed them. He saw that he thought that those were fundamental And if you have a view that's fundamentally based on insecurity or anxiety or some kind of desire, emotional desire to evade the truth, it can't in the end be a be something that will make us happy, because it is it's going to be leading us, there's going to be some element of evasion of reality, and that evasion is going to be the cause of our suffering. So I think that's why emotion, that's why we need to ask not only what we believe, but why do we believe it? And then there's another question, which is, no, really, why do we believe it? And I agree with the emphasis in the middle way society, as I understand it, that this is absolutely essential and is largely neglected by a lot of discussion about what we believe. I mean, it's completely absent from politics, for example.
Yeah.
Where it comes out as windy rhetoric when it is touched on at all. But, you know, not. So politics then becomes a matter of which shopping list you want to subscribe to, rather than no. What do you think's important? And why do you think that's important?
Yeah. And also, again, related to this, Vishnupani, can we have a view of objectivity in an incremental sense, rather than saying, you know, like the way we use it in everyday life, you know, you say, come on, be more objective about this. Can we then have a degree of accord about things like ethics or the arts? If you look at life in this way, rather than seeing things as two polar opposites, but we can have a degree of objectivity about things, if that makes sense.
Yes, I appreciate Robert's emphasis on incrementality, and that's very realistic.
Okay. Right, we touched on enlightenment, but as a Buddhist, do you believe in things such as karma and rebirth, or do you adopt more an agnostic position on those things?
Well, I think I do adopt an agnostic position, but my main reflection recently on rebirth is that when I look at the, I find I'm inherently skeptical. My grandmother had five husbands, and she spoke to them all frequently through a spiritualist medium. And she had a spirit guide who was a Red Indian chief. She remembered vividly her own past lives as a handmaiden of Princess Nefertiti.
Right.
And she wrote novels based on her past life experiences. And it always struck me as being rather amazing that the actual genuine past life experiences read in exactly the same way as trashy romantic potboilers. So I've never been without skepticism about rebirth, certainly as it's understood. But, again, steeping myself in the Buddhist texts in recent years, I'm very aware that the belief in rebirth is tied up with something else, which we've kind of, was there in every traditional society, and we've lost in our society, which is belief in ghosts and spirits and demons and all of those sorts of things. If you believe in ghosts, you believe in rebirth. Actually, if you believe in heaven, you believe in rebirth.
Yeah.
You may believe it in future lives. You may not believe in past lives. But and many people do believe in ghosts, actually. If I saw one, then maybe I would. But I haven't seen any ghosts. And I'm just aware that in traditional societies, all these things are part of life, part of daily life. And they're not in our society. So how can we... And I think rebirth actually comes out of that.
Yeah.
So I'm not saying that all the traditional societies of the world are wrong, but I'm just saying that I'm not a member of them. And so it just seems to me it's going to be intrinsically problematic to believe in rebirth, and actually to believe in heaven or anything like that. And at the same time, I'm not wholly convinced by the materialist perspective, which says the mind is the same as the body, finished. That's the end of it. That's all you can possibly say. And I don't think we really know what the mind is, actually. So that does lead me to an agnostic position. And I and so convinced of the Buddha's genius and his amazing insights that I'm willing to be open to the possibility that there was something in what he said about rebirth, although he doesn't seem to be that interested in it, really.
Do you think the Buddha was an agnostic?
No, the Buddha believed in rebirth. You can try and argue whatever you like, but all we know about the Buddha is what we get from texts, and the texts represent him as believing in rebirth, and not just believing it in the conventional way. That on the night of the Enlightenment, it said that he had three visions, the Tavijja. So the first was of his own rebirths, the past course of his rebirths. And the second was the past and future course of other beings' rebirths. And the third is the knowledge of destruction, the most fundamental traits within his mind. So that is the definition of enlightenment in the earliest texts we have.
And my last question, by agnostic, do you mean that you are waiting for further evidence, or that one can simply never ultimately know about these things?
I don't know. I'm agnostic about agnosticism. I'm not a philosopher, by the way, so may not be the right person to ask all these questions of definition. I can make something up if that would help.
Go on then.
No, I don't think I would carry very much weight or conviction.
All right then. Well, we'll leave it there, Vishwa Pandit. It's been absolutely fascinating talking to you today. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much. It's a pleasure.
You can find out more about Middle Way Philosophy at www.middlewaysociety.org.